You're listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit nakedbiblepodcast.com and click on the support link in the upper right-hand corner. If you're new to the podcast and Dr. Heiser's approach to the Bible, click on New Start Here at nakedbiblepodcast.com.
Welcome to the Naked Bible Podcast, episode 263, Exodus 3, part 3. I'm the layman, Trey Strickland, and he's the scholar, Dr. Michael Heiser. Lots of threes in this episode title, Mike.
Yep, three times. Am I messing this up? The third time is a charm.
Yeah, but this is actually the fourth, because this is our fourth episode.
Yeah, I know.
On
so
one
I did mess it up.
Chapter. Right. Four episodes on Exodus 3 alone. So that's a record. I think that's a record.
Yeah, we will bid it a fond farewell after this time. So
it's been great. Yeah.
We're not going to string it out anymore.
That's right. But Exodus 4 next week. But part 3 here, what are we going to be talking about?
Yeah, this is what everybody thinks of with chapter 3, the revelation of the divine name. So, you know, like, what does the name mean and some of that kind of stuff. You know, we'll try not to get too far into the nuts and bolts because I've got some stuff on my website about this. But yeah, that's our focus this time.
All right, well, looking forward to it.
Well, let's jump in. I'm going to start by reading Exodus 3. I'm just going to read for now the first, 14 or so verses, because again, this is the familiar part of the story that everybody thinks of when they think of, this chapter in the book. Now, Moses was keeping the flock of his father-in-law, Jethro, the priest of Midian, and he led his flock to the west side of the wilderness and came to Horeb, the mountain of God. And the angel of the Lord appeared to him in a flame of fire out of the midst of the bush. He looked, and behold, the bush was burning, yet it was not consumed. Then Moses said, I will turn aside to see this great sight, why the bush is not burned. When the Lord saw that he turned aside to see, God called to him out of the bush, Moses, Moses. And he said, Here I am. Then he said, Do not come near. Take your sandals off your feet, for the place on which you are standing is holy ground. And he said, I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob. And Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look at God. Then the Lord said, I have surely seen the affliction of my people who are in Egypt and have heard their cry because of their taskmasters. I know their sufferings, and I have come down to deliver them out of the hand of the Egyptians and to bring them up out of that land to a good and broad land, a land flowing with milk and honey. To the place of the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites. And now, behold, the cry of the people of Israel has come to me, and I have also seen the oppression with which the Egyptians oppressed them. Come, I will send you to Pharaoh, that you may bring my people, the children of Israel, out of Egypt. But Moses said to God, Who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the children of Israel out of Egypt? He said, But I will be with you. And this shall be the sign for you that I have sent you. When you have brought the people out of Egypt, you shall serve God on this mountain. Then Moses said to God, If I come to the people of Israel and say to them, The God of your fathers has sent me to you, and they ask me, What is his name? What shall I say to them? God said to Moses, I am who I am. And he said, Say this to the people of Israel, I am, has sent me to you. So we'll stop there. That's the first 14 verses. And I just want to make a few, sort of sidebar comments on our way to getting to the revelation of the divine name. You'll notice in verse 2, we have the angel of the Lord appearing. The verb there in Hebrew is ra'ah. It is the same verb and stem. Again, I'm not going to rabbit trail into Hebrew stems, but they're important. Same verb and stem that we see in some other passages. Now, if you've read my book, Unseen Realm, you're going to be familiar with chapters 12, 13, and 14, which deal with, God in human form in the Old Testament. And of course, this is part of it. The word of the Lord is part of it. The angel of the Lord is part of it. The name theology, the angel, we're going to get to this in Exodus 23, that has the name of God in him. It's another way of saying the presence of God. Glory of God is in that particular angel, which is why he's identified with Yahweh. You should be familiar with all that stuff. If you have not read Unseen Realm on these concepts, I would recommend that you do that. And I can't really reproduce the book content in episodes, so you're going to have to settle for a bit of a summary here. But that's the place to go. But part of that discussion is, again, God in human form, God appearing. And so you have a verse like Genesis 12:7 that says, then the Lord, Yahweh, the divine name, again, when in your English Bibles, when Lord is in all small capitals, that's the divine name. The divine name is present there in the Hebrew text. Then the Lord appeared to Abram and said, again, so on and so forth. This is the call of Abram, but it's appeared. And we find out, again, this is connected to the word of the Lord. You get to Jeremiah where the word of the Lord appears, you know, to Jeremiah. And the word of the Lord is actually called Yahweh in Jeremiah 1. And the word of the Lord reaches out his hand and touches the prophet. I mean, this is God in human form. You know, even in some senses, some passages, it's a corporeal, you know, encounter where God, you know, touches somebody. You get the same verb and stem here. Genesis 17:1. I'll just read a few of these. When Abram was 99 years old, the Lord appeared to Abram. Same verb and stem. 18:1. This is Genesis 18. This is when God and two angels show up at Abram's house and they have a meal. Okay, it's God, it's Yahweh in human form. First verse of that section. Genesis 18:1, and the Lord appeared to him, Abram, by the oaks of Mamre, as he sat at the door of his tent in the heat of the day. Again, same verb. Genesis 26:2, the Lord appeared to him. So he's going to, the same language is used of, you know, Isaac and Jacob, other patriarchs. Genesis 35:9, God appeared to Jacob again when he came to Padan Aram and blessed him. Chapter 48, again, if you've read Unseen Realm, you're familiar with Genesis 48:15-16, where the angel and God himself are fused by the grammar. They are co-identified with each other in Jacob's prayer. When he says, may the God of, you know, God who did this, the God who did that, the angel, you know, may he, singular verb form, may he bless the boys. And it's a tight identification of the angel with the Lord. And that chapter begins with, in verse 3, by this statement, Jacob said to Joseph, God Almighty appeared to me at Luz in the land of Canaan and blessed me. Again, referring back to some of these episodes where God showed up as a man in the Old Testament. 1 Samuel 3, kind of a classic instance. The story of the little boy Samuel, when he hears his name called out while they're trying to go to sleep, we find out it is Yahweh appearing and standing. Again, if it's just an invisible, disembodied voice, you don't describe something invisible as standing. How would you know? Samuel is seeing God, okay, again, in human form. This is anthropomorphic language. This verse here, 1 Samuel 3:21, the Lord appeared again at Shiloh, for the Lord revealed himself to Samuel at Shiloh by the word of the Lord. Again, all these verses, and there are more, of course, you can read Unseen Realm about this, but here, again, I think that it's important to point out the language. The Luke in Acts picks up on this too. Acts 7:30, in Stephen's, you know, speech there, we read, now when 40 years had passed, an angel appeared to him in the wilderness of Mount Sinai in a flame of fire in a bush. So Luke, again, is an observant reader drawing attention to an appearance. Again, if you want more detail, you can read Unseen Realm, chapters 12, 13, and 14. You notice as well in the verse, in verse 2, Exodus 3:2, there's just an interesting sort of comment. Moses looked, and behold, the bush was burning, yet it was not consumed. Okay, and so, you know, later on, we're going to read that Moses was afraid, at the end of verse 6, he was afraid to look at God. It doesn't say he was afraid to look at the fire. He was afraid to look at God. Again, this is the language of appearance used of the angel in all those other passages. Plus this one, this is God in human form in the bush, and Moses is freaked out, as I think we would all be. He's afraid to look at the bush. And again, you're not afraid to look at something invisible because it's invisible. How would you know you're even seeing it if it's invisible? Again, you got to think about the language being used here. It's important. You get to verse 5. This is where God tells Moses, don't come near, take your sandals off your feet, for the place on which you are standing is holy ground. And that, you know, is the same language repeated in Joshua 5, where you have the prince, the captain of the Lord's host, you know, shows up and Joshua sees him. So again, we have, looks just like a man. And Joshua says, essentially, whose side are you on? Are you friend or foe? And then the figure answers him, I'm the captain of the Lord's host. But on the one hand, you know, we don't have the term angel or angel of the Lord in that passage, but we do have two things. One of them is this same language drawn from Exodus 3. The captain of the Lord's host tells Joshua, take your shoes off your feet because you're standing on holy ground. It's exactly the same language. So, and that it's supposed to connect the visible form, the visible human form of God in Exodus 3 with that guy in Joshua 5. The other thing you have is you have the description in Joshua 5 that the captain of the Lord's host was standing there with drawn sword in his hand. Okay, that is a unique phrase in Hebrew. It's used only two other places in the entire Hebrew Bible. And I talk about this in Unseen Realm as well. And both of those places, it's the angel of the Lord, Numbers 22 and 1 Chronicles 20. So this is, again, the angel of the Lord. This is God in human form. It's not that difficult to see if you're comparing Scripture with Scripture. And again, we know that biblical writers are very fond of, and they're very purposeful, they're very intentional about repurposing parts of the Bible in what they're writing. And they're trying to get you to read something in front of your face and then mentally connect with something else to essentially connect the dots. And so that's what we're doing here. And again, Unseen Realm is filled with dot connecting of this kind. It's a close reading of Scripture. So again, if you want more detail, you can refer to that. Let's go down to verse 8. In verse 8, we have the statement, and I have come down to deliver them out of the hand of the Egyptians and to bring them up out of that land to a good and broad land, a land flowing with milk and honey, to the place of the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, the Jebusites. Now, a couple of things here. They're on a mountain, so the coming down, again, has to refer to God coming down from the heavens, again, from the skies. You know, this is a metaphor for where God would live. He doesn't live on earth. This is not his domain. It's our domain. Okay, it's a domain he created for humanity. He is transcendent. He actually resides, quote unquote. I mean, we have to use the vocabulary of embodiment, which is that's just the way it is because we're embodied, to talk about a being, God, that doesn't have a body, that can be anywhere at any time and all times at the same time. I mean, so again, we have to think a little bit about the language, but the coming down again is a reference to God coming from his place, which again was perceived either as the heavens, the skies, or, you know, somewhere that humans don't inhabit, mountains, the oceans. You know, this is where divine beings live, in these places that are not for human residence, that sort of thing. So he comes down, but I think what's really interesting about the let us go down that language, I have come down, then you have Genesis 11, it's the Babel incident, let us go down. It's the same verb, same Hebrew verb there. So God is coming from the heavens to act. Something's going to happen here when this language is used. And again, it's another little technique of the writers to help readers think about what's happening in the scene they're reading. And again, through similar language, what happened at other times, you know, when God came down, things happened. You know, God is acting. He's busy. He's getting to the task at hand. So it sort of preps the reader for, you know, being prepared that God is a God of action, and here we go. So I think that's an interesting thing to observe. As far as the people group names, the Canaanites, the Hittites, and so on and so forth, we're going to wait until I hit probably about Exodus 23 again to get into those names. You know, they're important, again, especially as it relates to the conquest and some of those other things. So we'll wait at that point, you know, to do that. Now, one thing I want to draw your attention to that I think is really important because of, you know, what we've covered in the last couple weeks about, you know, we asked the question, did Moses, had he ever heard of the name Yahweh? Like, should this be a shock? You know, and then does that mean he didn't worship the God of his fathers, you know, and so on and so forth. Here we actually have, I think, a pretty good clue as to how we might want to answer that question. We alluded to it alluded to this earlier in earlier episodes, but here we go. He says in, verse 13. Then Moses said to God, if I come to the people of Israel and say to them, the God of your fathers has sent me to you, and they ask me, what is his name? What shall I say to them? Now, I would suggest to you that Moses is not looking for a password here. He's not saying, okay, you know, if I go back to Egypt and go to the leadership there in Israel, I say, or they ask me, okay, you know, you claim to be sent by God. What's his name? In other words, it's not like a password situation. I would suggest to you that Moses is asking the question because he doesn't know. Right? He doesn't know. Otherwise, why would you ask the question? If you knew the answer to the question you're anticipating, you wouldn't need to ask the question. But since he asked the question, and now catch this, the answer is verse 14, God said to Moses, I am who I am. That suggests that the Israelites back in Egypt, they had heard that name before. Now, again, you can go back to the previous episodes and talk about how that might have been. But Moses doesn't know, and that's reasonable for him to not know this name. It's equally plausible that the Israelites back in Egypt did know this name. You know, and if you go back to the prior episodes, you know, this comes up. It's not just me. I mean, there are scholars who aren't theologically at all invested in this that I mentioned last time. Like Van der Torn was one where he says, look, you know, if the Midianites, if the Kenites, you know, had heard this name, these guys are itinerant. They're travelers. They're merchants. They go all over the place, including Egypt. And they're going to be trading not just with Egyptians, but you're going to have Semites down there who are in charge of Egyptian stuff, Egyptian households. They're going to either introduce this name based upon the, you know, alternate line, the non-Jacob line of Israel, or this is a name that, again, both lines had heard of at some point. But Moses gets turned over to Pharaoh's household when he's weaned. You know, he's a toddler. He's 2 years old or whatever. And he's raised in Pharaoh's household. It's entirely reasonable that he has never heard this. And he needs the answer. Why else would you ask the question? And again, since God gives him the answer that will satisfy the leadership in Israel, or the leadership of Israel back in Egypt, they had to have heard the name. So again, that this is going to affect how we think about Exodus 6:3 as we continue. We'll hit that point later on, but it's just an interesting thing to observe here in the text. Another thing, again, this is just a little bit scattershot here, but there are just some interesting things going on. If you look at verse 7, the Lord is the one speaking all this. Then the Lord said, "I have surely seen the affliction of my people who are in Egypt, so on and so forth, and I'm going to send you, Moses." And look at verse 12. God, Yahweh, is the speaker, but I will be with you, and this shall be the sign for you that I have sent you. When you have brought the people out of Egypt, you shall serve God on this mountain. Yahweh refers to God in the third person. Again, this is akin to some of these other things. Again, if you've read Unseen Realm or if you've heard me lecture on the two powers in heaven, this is another one of these passages. Now, you know, one instance of God referring to God in the third person, that's known as Iliism. It doesn't necessarily suggest, you know, a Godhead situation. It depends on the context of the particular passage. It's kind of interesting here, you know, because you do have a second figure in the bush. I don't know how far we can push it in this passage, but, you know, there are certainly, again, in the history of Jewish thinking about these sorts of passages, and I talk about this in my Two Powers lectures, that some of these really drew attention and started the, you know, rabbinic thinkers down a particular road. And I would say, you know, not just rabbinic thinkers. I'm thinking of Alan Siegel's work there, The Two Powers in Heaven, because after the first century, beginning into the second century, Judaism changed its theology to make this the second power idea a heresy. And that's in part, you know, certainly in response to Christians and their idea of a Godhead. But the point is that there was a Godhead kind of thing going on in the Old Testament. And at one point in Judaism, this was fine. You know, if you look at Second Temple literature, the intertestamental period, there's like 8 or 9 different candidates for who the second power is in the literature of that period. It was widely discussed in the Jewish community and was perfectly fine until the Christians came along. Then it was something that needed to be dealt with. But this is just another example of this kind of thing that would stimulate the discussion or contribute something to the discussion. Right here it is in Exodus 3, you know, the Lord referring to God in the third person. It's just kind of interesting. We get to verse 14. Again, here's where we're really going to camp for the rest of the episode in response to Moses' question. You know, if they ask me, what's his name? What shall I say? God said to Moses, I am who I am. And he said, say this to the people of Israel, I am has sent me to you. Again, this is the revelation of the divine name. Now, Carpenter, in his commentary, has, I think a pretty succinct and helpful summary here of sort of the options, that scholars have come up with as far as what does this mean? Because everybody wants to know what does the name of God mean? Because biblical names, this is pretty common knowledge. Biblical names typically have meanings. Either their constituent parts, form a sentence or something like that, or the name, is a correspondent to some other thing. So what does God's name mean? And scholars have just, this is well traversed territory for anybody really interested. It's kind of a central passage. And you really have more than just that issue. It's not just the meaning, but there's also the issue of the pronunciation. How should God's name be pronounced? So you've got kind of two issues here, but Carpenter, I think, has a decent summary. And here it is. He says, three main suggestions have been put forth to pinpoint the meaning of God's name and its proper translation. Number one, he says, one option stresses the presence of Yahweh. And so there are some scholars who would translate, I am here with you, I will be with you. Carpenter says this is clearly a part of the context. Verse 12 indicates that this narrowing of the name and its meaning is possible. Verse 12, God says to Moses, but I will be with you, and this shall be the sign for you. And then that prompts, Moses' question. Well, if they ask me what your name is, what do I say? This idea of the name actually meaning or sort of being focused on presence is one sort of trajectory that has been followed in scholarship. So trying to take the context or take verse 14 and make its context verse 12, this idea of God being with someone. So I am that I am meaning, well, God is promising to be there. He's I am, and I'm going to be with you. So again, scholars try to connect those two ideas. Second, others have championed something like, quote, I am he who causes to be all that is. I am him who causes to be, unquote. So this, Carpenter says, argues for a, again, sorry for the grammar speak here, argues for a hifil stem, a causative vocalization of the verbal name phrase. So the name comes, as it's given here, from Haya. And we talked about in South Semitic, that the root might mean to blow, and so you get he blows, which is a reference to the wind on the top of the mountain, the storm, theophany kind of thing. We talked about that a week or so ago, about if you were in Midian and you were a South Semitic language speaker, you might be thinking of that verbal root in association with the YHW or YW name. Okay, on the West side, the West Semitic, when Hebrew is part of this, the root would be the to-be verb, haya, which in older Semitic would be hava, H-W-H versus H-Y-H. They mean exactly the same thing, and they are the exact same thing. Again, without getting into historical grammar, the Y and the W were interchangeable in a number of words in Semitic languages. So if you're looking at it from the West Semitic side, you've got the to-be verb, and so the translation in the first person is I am. Okay, I am who I am. But if you go to the third person, now you have something a little bit different, which is this number two option about causation. So if you wanted to drill down and get all the nuts and bolts details of this, I'm gonna direct you to my website. Go to drmsh.com. Just put it into Google, drmsh.com, and put in YHWH. You're going to find the page where I discuss all this in sort of excruciating detail. But when God answers Moses' question, I am, that is the first person. First person is me. I'm number one, okay? First person is I with verbs. I run, I pass, I chase or something. That's first person language. Second person is you. You run, you chase, you pass, okay? And then third person is somebody else. So it's I, you, and then everybody else. So he. Now in Hebrew, you take a verb like the to-be verb, the haya, and the way you express the third person is to stick a Y on the front, a prefix. So now you have YHWH, which is the divine name in the third person. Now, how do we pronounce that? In if you use the same Hebrew stem as the first person here, it would be Yeh, and it means he is or he will be. The problem with that, though, is in the Hebrew Bible, you have a short form of the divine name, just the first syllable, YH, and it's always with an A vowel, Yah, always. So Yahweh instead of Yehweh or Yeh. Again, the Y and the W are exchangeable in older Hebrew. So if you have an A vowel under the first syllable, there's only one way to sort of account for that grammatically. An A-class vowel followed by an I-class vowel is the hifil. It is the causative stem. And that's why many scholars argue, look, if you got a to-be verb and the short form has an A vowel, Yahweh, that means he who causes something to be. I guess that's the best way to say it. He who causes to be. He who creates. It's really a statement of creation, you know, creator. A deity with the ability to make something real that has not yet existed, okay? He who causes to be, who brings something into being. And this is, you know, this has a long history in scholarship and in discussion of the name. W.F. Albright argued for this back in the 20s and later. Frank Moore Cross from Harvard, who was Albright's student. You know, Cross is very familiar to anybody who read Biblical Archaeology Review in the 80s, 70s, 80s, and 90s. He argued for this position. Cross's article is kind of famous, Yahweh and the God of the Patriarchs, Harvard Theological Review, Volume 55, 1962, is sort of his full explication of this. David Noel Friedman in Journal of Biblical Literature in the 60s as well argued for this. So these are some top-tier scholars of their time, their era, arguing for a causative understanding of the name. Third option, we'll return to the causative in a moment, but the third option is other scholars sort of opt for a more straightforward translation of the verbal phrase as it stands, this is Carpenter's wording, and as it is vocalized in the MT. So they would actually just not sort of favor, or I'm going to be a little bit blunt here, not really pay attention to the short form, the A vowel. They would go with Yeh-Veh or Yeh-Yeh, third person of the verbal to-be root. And they would translate, I will be who I will be. And the implication for those who take this position is that Yahweh will reveal who he is through the things he is about to do to deliver Israel. And again, I mean, you can make a good, you know, argument for that in the context. Now, those are the three views that Carpenter outlines. I'm going to add a fourth view here, and this is from an article that I am putting in the protected folder. It's actually something you could Google and find it online. It's you know, there's a link to it online in various places. It's by Charles Isbell. That's Isbel, and the title is "The Divine Name," and it has Hebrew characters here. But the divine name Ehyeh, as a symbol of presence in Israelite tradition. And the publication is the Hebrew Annual Review, Volume 2, 1978, and it's 17 pages, pages 101 through 118. Again, I put this in the folder. What's interesting about this is Isbell's article focuses on the first person form, that God's name, in not just in this passage, because look at what God says here. Moses asks him, you know, what's your name? And God said to Moses, I am who I am. He doesn't say, now you should call me Yahweh. You know, he doesn't use the third person. God says, I am who I am. Say this to the people of Israel. I am, Ehyeh, has sent me to you. He doesn't say to the people of Israel, Yahweh has sent me to you. If you actually, you know, look at in the passage what God's answer is, he uses the first person instead of the third person. And so Isbell, his article is focused on this. He basically asks kind of a logical question. Well, are there other passages in the Hebrew Bible where the first person form is used as a proper name? And there are a handful. I mean, there's like a couple thousand in the third person. But there actually are a couple of instances where the first person form is used as the name. So I want to throw Isabel in here because this is a bit of a different trajectory that's interesting. And I'm going to read you a few things by way of summary here. Again, you can reference Isabel's work here, but just, again, trying to summarize the content for the sake of the episode here. He writes, and again, part of this is him, part of this is me summarizing. It is necessary to establish from the beginning the fact that both in biblical and post-biblical traditions, again, the first person form, is used as a proper noun, essentially as an allomorph of the more common form, Yahweh. Now, an allomorph is an alternate form. That's all the fancy linguistic word allomorph means. So Isabel's saying it's just a fact that you're going to have instances where the first person form is used like an alternative, proper name, an alternative to the third person form that is much more common. Back to the content here, clearly the starting point for this understanding must be Exodus 3:14, as Bell says, where it has long been recognized that the phrase, Ehyeh has sent me, is the precise equivalent of Yahweh has sent me in the very next verse. Now, let's go back to Exodus 3. Now, I'm going to read it. I'm going to start in verse 13 again. Now, just look at what the text does. Then Moses said to God, if I come to the people of Israel and say to them, the God of your fathers has sent me to you, and they ask me, what is his name? What shall I say to them? God said to Moses, I am who I am. Ehyeh asher ehyeh. Okay. And he said, again, God is still the speaker. And God said, say this to the people of Israel. I am, Ehyeh has sent me to you. Now here's verse 15. God also said to Moses, say this to the people of Israel. Yahweh, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob, has sent me to you. Both verses have God saying to Moses, say this to them. And they both have a deity has sent me to you. But in verse 14, it's Ehyeh, and in verse 15, it's Yahweh, or Yahyeh, however you want to say that. The Y and the W, again, are interchangeable. So Ehyeh, Yahweh, back to back, those two verses, first person, third person, in exactly the same formulation as God's answer to Moses, which is really interesting, and it's very easy to not notice that. So back to Isabel, he says the third example, again, in the course of his article, he has other examples, but he refers to a couple of things. Like one of the things, he refers to Psalm 50, I think it's Psalm 50 or 51. It's Psalm 50, verse 21 he uses. And then his third example is one I'm going to pluck out here. Well, I might as well take them in order. The three examples that Isabel uses are Psalm 50, 21, 2 Samuel 7, 6, and Hosea 1, 9. He says in all three of these instances, the Hebrew syntax, and again, if you know some Hebrew, you'll benefit from Isabel's article. If you don't, you can still get some things out of it, which is why I put it in the folder. And you could Google it too. But in all three of these verses, the grammar, the syntax, not only allows for Ehyeh to be a proper personal deity name, but pretty much requires it. I mean, he makes a good argument. Hosea 1:9, the ESV has it translates it this way. And the Lord said, call his name not my people. Again, this is the child of Hosea and Gomer. Okay. Call his name not my people, for you are not my people. And ESV has, I am not your God. But what Isabel says is the way you really should translate this is, you are not my people, and I am is not your God. Like it's an actual proper name. 2 Samuel 7, 6, God says again to David, this is the Davidic covenant passage, I have not lived in a house since the day I brought up the people of Israel from Egypt to this day, but I have been moving about in a tent for my dwelling. Isabel argues that the last part of that verse should be translated, I am has been moving about in a tent, okay, for my dwelling. So that the point would be, Ehyeh, as a proper name, was the one, you know, traveling in the tent and living in the tabernacle, that kind of thing. So again, his argument is going to be, you know, grammatical and syntactical. What's the last one? Or the other one that we didn't get to yet. Psalm 50:21. These things you have done, and I have been silent, and thought that I was, you thought that I was one like yourself. But now I rebuke you and lay the charge before you. So that's ESV. Isbell argues this. He says it should be translated something like this. These things you have done, and I have been silent. You thought that I am was like you, but now I'm going to rebuke you. Okay, so on and so forth. So there, he points out these three passages, and here's his conclusion. Again, if you're interested in this, and I find it personally interesting, you can get the article, but here's Isbell's conclusion and why I wanted to lump him in the name discussion. He writes, the self-disclosure of Yahweh plainly included the willingness to speak a personal word about himself, to put himself on the spot promissorily, like God's going to promise Moses some things here, and openly. It included his readiness to say, I will be with you, I will become God to you, and to say these things before his capacity to act changingly had been demonstrated in a given situation, but also before the capacity of Israel to be a people in a new situation had been demonstrated. In short, Yahweh's self-disclosure involved no less than his willingness to say to Israel, I am. In other words, this is my name, I am. And is the Israelites were supposed to again think or conclude that, well, that can only mean one thing. God is going to be with us. He's promised to be with us, and he will be with us. In other words, Isbell's, you know, is saying this is what their response would have been to the first person, I am. That's your answer, I am. So he links it to the promise language that you're going to find a little bit, you know, as we keep reading, and then the acts that God does, you know, in history for Israel. Isbell continues, for Israel, this divine willingness to say, eh, yeah, I am, implied that faith must not be withheld until after a demonstration of divine power. Let me just stop there. When God says, I am, God expected them to respond with faith. Well, that's the answer. We wanted to know, you know, what was going on, and God says, you know what, here's my name, I am. They were supposed to interpret that as a promise to be with them and then respond accordingly before God ever even got down to business. Before he did anything spectacular, he wanted them to respond in faith. Of course, look what Moses does. It's anything but a response to faith, and he's the leader. But again, Isbell is arguing that this is the point. He, you know, faith must not be withheld until after a demonstration of divine power, faith which could so easily be retracted at the hint of a new crisis, in which God had not yet acted specifically and openly to the satisfaction of everyone. Thus, if the saying of "Eh, yeah, I am," meant that God had accepted His covenant responsibility to Israel in advance. Okay, in advance of and irregardless of particular untoward circumstances, it also constituted a challenge for Israel to respond covenantally as people in advance of whatever might lie in the future. For the faith of Israel to become as forward-looking as was the promise of God to be present would be to approach the real meaning of being people and would make possible the desired relationship of covenant. That's the end of his conclusion. So I think this is a really worthwhile article. It's going to sound new because everybody's sort of fixated on Yahweh. And again, for the life of me don't understand why people get hung up on this. Oh, the right pronunciation of God's name is Yahshua or Yeshua or you know the alphabet soup with the two consonants or whatever. You know, why do we get fixed on this? I mean, there are people out there who spend more time on this, and they're not linguistically informed, than they do on the Great Commission or something, you know, that Jesus told us to do. Or, you know, I still don't understand it. But what apparently they don't get is that, yeah, guess what? That's a proper name for God too. And you'll never see that brought into the discussion, because that, you know, rattles the cage. It's a fly in the ointment, you know, for these people that are fixated on this kind of discussion. Again, that for the most part, they don't get right anyway. you know, I'll be honest with you. Sometimes I can't tell what in the world, you know, where in the world they're coming from as far as the pronunciations are offered. Sometimes they're clear. You know, they have some relationship to Hebrew, like, you know, it's like the first syllable especially. But again, this is not a hill to die on, the exact pronunciation. You've actually got, you know, well, throw Isbel in here because, you know, and that's just the first person. So you've got three reasonable approaches to the third person form. And you've got one that focuses on the first person form. They're all viable. And I think regardless of which of the three third person forms you pick, the first person form is there. It just is what it is, pardon the pun. So you have to accept that in your talk about God's name as well. You just must, because that's what the text has in a few places. Where I'm at, I'm still at number two, the Hithil form of the third person. People, again, can go up to my website, again, put it in Google, drmsh.com, and the four consonants, YHWH, you're going to find the page. I still think number two is appealing. I have a detailed discussion up there. I favor the second view for the third person translation. I am he who causes to be, you know, all that is. And it just makes sense to me. I have also, and we're going to have a link to this on the episode page. There's also a video of me on YouTube going through, you know, some software. It's a screen capture video of why the pronunciation, you know, is what it is, you know, that sort of thing. And it's not something else. So if you want more detail, you can drill down on those things. So I don't really see anything. There's no conclusive argument against number two. Now, people, scholars, you know, pick at it because they'll say things like, well, you know, the haya or the hava verb, we don't see that in the Hithil causative stem in any other of the Northwest Semitic languages. Okay. Do we have to have a corresponding Northwest Semitic form for every blasted word in the vocabulary of the Hebrew Bible? Do we have to have that? No. And it doesn't work in reverse either. I mean, nobody's going to say, well, look at this form in Ugaritic, you know, and no, I reject that because I can't find that form in the Hebrew Bible. That can't be real Semitic. Nobody says that. So I think that sort of criticism is skewered. Again, I'm not going to get into what might be the motivating such things, but that's the kind of argument you'll see against taking the third person form as a Hithil causative stem form. I just don't find that persuasive. I don't really see any reason that this can't be. It makes a lot of sense. But again, the other options are viable too. And I do really appreciate Isbel's contribution with the first person form of the name. I want to take some sidebar notes now on the divine name itself. There are just a few interesting things that I think, you know, this audience will appreciate, and do a little bit of drill down here just to talk about the name in maybe a slightly different way. In Sarna's commentary, his Exodus commentary, he writes this, Ehya Asher Ehya. Again, this phrase has variously been translated, I am that I am who I am, I will be that I will be, or what I will be. It clearly evokes Yahweh, you know, YHWH, the specific proper name of Israel's God. Again, that's the third person form. The one known in English as the Tetragrammaton, that is, the four consonants. The phrase also indicates that the earliest recorded understanding of the divine name was as a verb derived from the stem HVH, Hava, or H, you know, YH, Haya. HVH is an earlier form of HYH, the to-be verb. Either it expresses the quality of absolute being, the eternal, unchanging, dynamic presence, or it means he causes to be. Again, there's the Hithil, you know, perspective. YHWH is the third person masculine singular. Ehya is the corresponding first person singular. This latter is used here because name giving in the ancient world implied the wielding of power over the one named. This is all, you know, a little sidebar to the sidebar. This is why, like in demonic texts, you know, an exorcist will want to know the name of the demon, because it was believed that if you have the name of the demon, you could exercise power over it. This sort of thinking. Back to Sarna. This latter is used here because name giving in the ancient world implied the wielding of power over the one name. Hence, the divine name can only proceed from God himself. So what Sarna is saying, the reason God uses the first person here is so that the person asking for the information couldn't use the third person. and get it right. Now, I don't know. I mean, it's kind of an interesting note. Maybe that's in view. Again, it's you're not going to find a whole lot of defense of that idea, but it, you know, it's interesting for what it's worth. And Sarna then adds an interesting note. Now, catch this. In the course of the Second Temple period, let me repeat that. In the course of the Second Temple period, Second Temple period, roughly in round numbers, is 500 BC to 70 AD or 100 AD. We'll make it even rounder, okay? In the course of the Second Temple period, the Tetragrammaton came to be regarded as charged with metaphysical potency and therefore ceased to be pronounced. It was replaced in speech by Adonai, Lord, rendered in Greek Kurios. Often the vowels of Adonai would later accompany YHWH in written texts when vowels were added in the early medieval period. This gave rise to the mistaken form, Jehovah. The original pronunciation was eventually lost and modern attempts at recovery are conjectural. At the end of the selection. What do I want you to notice there? That people only got the notion, as far as the textual evidence, okay, and the historical evidence goes, they only got the notion of not pronouncing the name in the Second Temple period. That means earlier, we have no idea if Israelites felt free to say Yahweh or yeah, they very well could have. So this notion that from the moment of the conversation on Sinai at the burning bush, people would not pronounce the name of God, there's actually no way to prove that, and there's no proof for it. In the Second Temple period, there's a lot of proof for it, because that is the point. That's the point, textually, where we see these kind of changes with the divine name happen in the texts. So it's an assumption that, you know, you couldn't pronounce the name as an Israelite really prior to 500 BC. But there's no way to establish that. Anchor Bible Dictionary adds this. The form Jehovah results from reading the consonants of the Tetragrammaton, again, YHWH, with the vowels of the surrogate word Adonai. Now you say word Adonai begins with an A, Jehovah begins with an E. How does that work? It's a feature of Hebrew consonants. Okay, Adonai is a guttural. It begins with a guttural consonant, and the shva, the vocal shva under a guttural is going to be the A class. The Jehovah begins with a yod. That is not a guttural. And so the vocal shva under that will be eh. Again, end of linguistic spasm there. But they're the same thing. It's just they're linguistic reasons why one is ah or a and one is e. Okay. Back to the selection. The form Jehovah results from reading the consonants of the Tetragrammaton with the vowels of the surrogate Adonai. The dissemination of this form is usually traced to Petrus Galatinus, confessor to Pope Leo X, who in 1518 AD transliterated the four Hebrew letters with the Latin letters, okay, J, H, V, H, together with the vowels of Adonai, producing the artificial form Jehovah. This confused usage may, however, have begun as early as 1100 AD. I mean, there is a manuscript or two that you know you can show to make that argument. While the hybrid form Jehovah has met much resistance and is universally regarded as an ungrammatical aberration, it nonetheless passed from Latin into English and other European languages and has been hallowed by usage in hymns and the ASV. It is used only a few times in the KJV and not at all in the RSV. Now that's from Thompson's article on Yahweh in the Anchor Bible Dictionary. Why do I bring this up? First, Jehovah is an artificial form. It is an incorrect form. Whether you want to tell that to Jehovah's Witnesses or not, that's up to you. And frankly, it isn't going to matter to them. Jehovah's Witnesses, A, they don't know Hebrew, and B, if you know they're not Hebrew linguists. You know, it's not going to phase them. So I wouldn't bother with that. It's more something that you should know. I used to, when I had seminary students, again, who had at least a year of Hebrew, I would mark off if I ever saw Jehovah in a paper, and I would say, you should know better. Okay, just stop it. Why did you take first year? I mean, I wasn't this cruel, okay? What, you know, why did you take first year Hebrew? I mean, like get with the program here. Know what's going on. So that's, I bring it up for that reason. And also, again, to show you how recent this is. I mean, you have a really good textual basis for saying this is like around the time of Luther. You know, this starts maybe earlier, but it's not anywhere close to being in the biblical period. At the earliest, this is 1100 AD. That would be over a millennium after Jesus. Okay, we're in two millennium when you go back into the Old Testament period. That's a long time. So I don't want to hear this talk about Jehovah, you know, being the actual, you know, name of God. It's not. It has a traceable history. Another publication, I have put this one in the folder as well, by Kristen DeTroyer. This article is called The Names of God, Their Pronunciation, and Their Translation. Subtitle, A Digital Tour of Some of the Main Witnesses. Again, you can actually find that on the internet, but I put it in the folder anyway. The last name is D-E with a space, and then Troyer, T-R-O-Y-E-R. Kristen DeTroyer, The Names of God. Put that into Google, you'll find it, or you can use the protected folder. You have to be a newsletter subscriber to get to the protected folder. DeTroyer writes this on pages 3 to 5. I'm just plucking out a few paragraphs here and there on pages 3 and 5. What does one read in old codices, such as Codex Leningrad and Codex Aleppo? Now, I'll stop there. These are the two oldest complete or mostly complete manuscripts of the Hebrew Bible that we have. Leningradensis is the oldest complete Hebrew Bible. And we know, I'm trying to remember, I always get this, I always have to look it up, and I didn't look it up before. And it's either 1007 or 1107 AD, because the scribe, the copyist, put the date on it. Aleppo is not complete. It's missing most of the Torah because of a fire, but that's in the 900s. Okay? What do those manuscripts, how do they point or vocalize the divine name? Good question. Most of the printed Hebrew Bibles, this is back to DeTroyer, most of the printed Hebrew Bibles are based on Codex Leningrad, or Leningradensis, a codex dated to, there we go, you know, 1007, 1008. She has, I've seen the other one, just say 1008 since we're dealing with her article here. Located at the Library of St. Petersburg, again in Russia, this codex is the oldest complete Hebrew Bible. Most scholarly editions of the Bible are based on this codex. Now, that's certainly true. There is a Hebrew Bible project in operation now that's using Aleppo as its starting point, but you know, we'll wait for that to get completed. Back to DeTroyer. The usual form of the name of God, however, in Codex Leningrad is, now this is interesting. Here's how it's pointed. It's YHWH, again, reading right to left here in Hebrew, or, you know, in English, YHWH, it has the E vowel and the final A vowel. In other words, there is no O vowel. Let me say that again. The usual form of the name of God in Codex Leningradensis does not have the O vowel. So again, if you have people, well, Jehovah, that'd be Leningradensis. No. And may I add, no. It has yeh and then va, yeh, va. There's no O vowel. There's a you know, the scribe just didn't, that wasn't the way you pronounced it. That wasn't the way you pointed it. The O vowel is missing. So DeTroyer says, in other words, there's a holom, an O sound missing in the printed form of the Tetragrammaton. The first form, this e, okay, yeh, va, e, a, and with the missing O, her approach, and it's not unique to her, but she says this form can be read as the Aramaic noun Shema, because that has the E-Ah, which is the word for the name, the divine name. So her view is that the reason why they took the four consonants in Leningradensis, or, you know, and Leningradensis, again, is early 11th century, and that's going to be a copy of a copy of a copy. I mean, it has a long history, so, you know, back into the early Middle Ages, we'll say, when they wanted to add vowels to the divine name, they added an E sound, it's a vocal Shiva, and then the comments on the last syllable. Taking the vowels not from Adonai has an O vowel in there, but taking the vowels from Shema, the name. And if you take those vowels, put them into the four consonants, two vowels plus four consonants, you get Yehva. Okay. It's just kind of interesting. It's a little bit of Masoretic trivia. I don't know. But it makes sense that they would do that. The name, okay, we'll take the vowels from the name and put them in the name. Makes sense. And but Jehovah does not have a traceable history back into the major manuscripts is the point. Detroit, I don't know if it's a woman or a man, Kristen with a K, probably a woman, but let's just say Detroyer, continuing, writes this. Indeed, like many Jewish readers of the Bible today do, God is referred to in the margins of the Masoretic Bible as HaShema, the name, the Jewish Aramaic word for the name. The oldest complete copy of the Hebrew Bible does hence not render the Tetragrammaton with the Lord, Adonai, but with the name. Similarly, Codex Aleppo and the editions of the Rabbinic Bible have the same thing, have the name instead of Adonai. That's where they take the vowels too. Now, she or he says, I acknowledge that there are a couple of exceptions to this rule, namely a couple of places where Codex Leningradensis has Adonai as a kere. Okay, kere is a note in the margin from another scribe that says this is what you should read. But what's actually in the text doesn't have the O vowel, but some scribe came along and in a few places put in the margin, read this. Read it with the O vowel. Again, so you had somebody at some point want to do it differently in a handful of places. Not at certain, nowhere near every place, but you know, a handful of places. So Detroyer is acknowledging that. Then he or she moves on to another point and asks, was the name pronounced or not? There is no explanation as to why the Tetragrammaton was no longer pronounced. Moreover, all hypotheses regarding the origins of the Kethiv-Kere phenomenon, Kethiv is what is read, what you find in the text, and then Kere is this marginal note, here's what to read. All hypotheses regarding the origins of that system, the Kethiv-Kere phenomenon, are speculative. In the Jewish tradition, there are plenty of statements regarding the non-pronunciation of the name of God. In the Mishnah, Tractate Sanhedrin 10:1, for instance, it is clearly stated that the name of God cannot be pronounced. Now, let me stop there. That's the Mishnah. All right, this is medieval. This is rabbinic stuff. This isn't biblical stuff. Again, I recently posted something about why we shouldn't be appealing to, you know, to rabbis for biblical exegesis. I don't know how much clearer I can make it. The rabbinic period in history is not synonymous with the biblical period. It's later. In some cases, century, maybe, in some cases, even a millennium. Okay. This is Mishnah. So by the time of the Mishnah, again, you're early Middle Ages. Okay. There is commentary about not pronouncing the name. Only the high priest, back to Detroyer, only the high priest, more specifically on Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, can utter the name of God. All other Jews are not supposed to pronounce the name of God. This is the opinion that's in the Mishnah. Continuing, from a difference between the Masoretic text of the Hebrew Bible and its Greek Septuagint translation, Martin Rizal deduces that only by the time of the Greek translation of the Book of Leviticus, the Tetragrammaton was no longer pronounced. And again, the Septuagint is Second Temple period. That's when the Septuagint was translated. Back to Detroyer. According to most scholars, this was somewhere at the end of the 3rd century BCE. The Septuagint of Leviticus reads, quote, "And he that names the name of God, let him die the death," unquote. Whereas the Hebrew text can be read as, quote, "He who uses the name of God in vain," unquote. So the Septuagint gets interpretive there. It takes the Hebrew, "he who uses the name of God in vain," or takes the name, you know, lifts up the name of the Lord in vain. The Septuagint interprets that to say that you shouldn't name the name of God. And again, she's quoting a scholar that says, this is the earliest kind of reference I can find to this sort of mentality. So again, back to Sarna, this is what Sarna had said. In the Second Temple period is when you start to see this transition toward not saying the divine name. But before that, you don't. You don't have that. There is also the Isaiah Qumran scroll. This is the great Isaiah scroll, 1Q Isaiah A, that reads Adonai in 3:7, where the Masoretic text has the Tetragrammaton. So in that text, there's a substitution. The scribe of, you know, the Isaiah scroll there did not write the Tetragrammaton, but actually put in the word Adonai. Detroyer says, this means that by the late 2nd century BCE, the presumed date of the Isaiah scroll, the Tetragrammaton might have been read as Adonai. So it's suggestive of that. One last comment from Detroyer. The names of God section in her you know, essay. There are two important collections of data that one has to take into account when dealing with the name of God. The Elephantine papyri and the Samaritan papyri from Wadi Dalia. They show that the following names of God were in use. Okay, so now you're going back to the 5th century BC. This is earlier. Well, it's earlier in the Second Temple period, you know, but almost back, you know, to the, you know, the days of Ezra and Nehemiah. Let's just think of it that way. They show that the following names of God were in use. You have YHWH, YHW, YHH, Yahoh, vocalized, or Yahoo, and YH, which would be Yah. The Elephantine papyri date to the 5th century BC. The Wadi Dalia papyri stem from the 4th century BCE. The Elephantine papyri contain the correspondence from the Jewish officials of the Elephantine community to the officials in Samaria and Jerusalem regarding the rebuilding of their recently destroyed temple. So you push it back a little bit. There are multiple forms of the divine name in those texts. Again, and this is a period before the texts were, you know, before the vowels were added. The vowels were only added, again, in the Middle Ages. But in the Second Temple period, before the vowels were added, you have things like scribes taking the divine name out and putting in Adonai, or you have, you know, the instance that we just read where they'll do some other kind of thing in the text to make it seem, again, like, you know, they're trying not to write it or pronounce it. You only see that, you, again, begin, you know, the evidence for that is right around the 3rd century BCE or BC, right in the middle, you know, so to speak, of the Second Temple period. You go a century earlier, and you have texts that not only have the four consonants in there, but they actually have variations. And some of the variations can only be vocalized one way, like YH, Yah, even though they don't have vowels in them, but that's the textual situation as it is. So at least back then, there doesn't seem to be any predilection towards swapping the divine name out. But a century later, you know, you start to see that. And, you know, you go a little bit beyond that. And that's when, you know, back to Sarna. Sarna says it's really in this period that you start to see this notion develop that you shouldn't pronounce the divine name. But before that, you actually can't argue that. There's actually no evidence for it. So, you know, should we really be taking a Second Temple sort of custom, scribal custom, and presuming that when scribes sat down in the exile or earlier to write a biblical text or to edit a biblical text, that they were doing this kind of thing? Well, we really can't. We don't have any evidence for it. So, you know, just take that for what it's worth. It's just kind of interesting. Well, let's go to verse 18. We're going to finish the chapter here. Just a few more observations. We'll be out of chapter 3 finally. Verse 18, we read this. You know, we've had this conversation with God, you know, this is my name, so on and so forth. You know, you go to the, you know, to the leadership in Israel, verse 18, we read, they will listen to your voice. God says to Moses, look, they'll listen. They will listen to your voice, and you and the elders of Israel shall go to the king of Egypt and say to him, the Lord, the God of the Hebrews, has met with us, and now please let us go a 3 days journey into the wilderness that we may sacrifice to the Lord our God. I just want to draw attention briefly to the elders here. It's kind of an overlooked group. There are a lot of good articles on this. Elder in the Old Testament, in Interpreter's Dictionary of the Bible, Davies, G.H. Davies wrote that particular entry. He writes this. Elders are thus represented as a constant feature of Israel's life from the days of Moses to those of Ezra. And they were as prominent under the monarchy as before it. elders are mentioned over 41 times in the Pentateuch. And that's a lot more than you would think. Carpenter, in his commentary, adds, elders are mentioned at least 12 times in Exodus, from 3:16 to Exodus 24:14. Moses always works with or through them, never against them. But do you notice a bit of a problem here, or at least some would say this is a problem? You have back again in verse 16, you know, go and gather the elders of Israel together. And then verse 18, God says, look, they're going to listen to you. You and the elders go to the king, blah, 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 blah. Some would say, well, that's anachronistic because we only get elders in Exodus 18, you know, with Jethro. Hey, you need some help here, Moses. You need to appoint people. But it's actually not. This verse doesn't preempt or it's not misplaced before Exodus 18. Because in Exodus 18, you don't have the word elders. Moses, at Jethro's advice, appoints judges. It's a different word. Specifically, Exodus 18, 21-22 is where you get this. So we don't have anachronistic things. There's going to be anachronistic things in Exodus, and we'll hit them when we come there. But my point is that, you know, if you come along, you know, this sort of thing, it's not anachronistic. There's not a one-to-one equation between judges and elders, okay, even though a lot of the discussion sort of assumes that. Sarna adds that the elders of verse 16 are the elders, Hebrew zekanim, who are frequently mentioned in the Exodus narratives, though little information about them is offered. I mean, as you just heard, it's more than a dozen times, you know, even in the book itself, and over 40 times, you know, just generally. So, you know, what do we have here? When Moses goes to the Israelite leadership in Egypt, again, at the end of chapter 4, Exodus 4:31 is when he actually gets around to doing this. And when he meets with Pharaoh, which is Exodus 5, guess what? The elders, the leadership that's already in Egypt. Again, this has nothing to do with the appointees under Jethro after they get out, after they leave Egypt. The elders who are already there, they do what God said they would do. They believe Moses. They believe him. So God had anticipated that. And again, he had anticipated Pharaoh's resistance as well. Exodus 3:18. Again, they will listen to your voice. You and the elders of Israel go to the king of Egypt and say, the Lord God of the Hebrews has met with us. You know, let us go out and sacrifice the Lord our God. Verse 19, but I know that the king of Egypt will not let you go unless compelled by a mighty hand. So I will stretch out my hand and strike Egypt with all the wonders that I will do in it after he will let you go. And I will give this people favor in the sight of the Egyptians. And when you go, you shall not go empty, but each woman shall ask of her neighbor, and any woman who lives in her house, for silver and gold jewelry, and for clothing. And you shall put them on your sons and on your daughters, so you shall plunder the Egyptians. That's the end of Exodus 3. Exodus 3, of course, anticipates chapter 4, and, you know, chapters 4 through 6, really. And really, most of what follows, you know, with respect to the confrontation with Pharaoh and the plagues and all that, God is going to do something new. He has come down, again, think of that, going down, coming down language. He has come down to act and fulfill his covenant and guarantees the outcome by virtue of his presence. And again, back to what Isbell said, if the whole point of using the first person is to essentially say, I am, in other words, God has decided to act now and to be with them, and he expects their response to be the same before God ever even rolls up his sleeves and gets down to business. To me, that's not only interesting, but it's kind of a compelling point. It's a good preaching point, actually, of what the name itself might convey in that particular form. So, you know, we're set up now to get into Exodus 4 and the confrontation with Pharaoh, I think, pretty well, you know, as far as what God expects, what God has promised, both directly and implicitly for the rest of the story.
All right, Mike, you sure? Do we need a part 4? We got it.
I am positive. I am positive.
All right, that sounds good.
Let us flee from chapter 3.
That sounds good. No, it was a good one. Who would have thunk that chapter 3 could have so much behind it?
Yeah, it's interesting. There's a lot of stuff sort of hidden in the cracks.
Yeah, absolutely. We look forward to chapter 4 next week. And I want to thank everybody for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. God bless.
Thanks for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit www.nakedbibleblog.com.
To learn more about Dr. Heiser's other websites and blogs, go to www.drmsh.com.